so quiet out there. Yosemite shut down. Lincoln Memorial's all chained up and sad. But we're about to get loud in here because the closing of the federal government does not deter people like me from continuing to answer your questions about what really goes on behind the scenes in show business. So let's get to episode 27 of The Femme Fatale, shall we? I'm your host, Leslie Gornstein. I take your tweets, I take your emails, I take your Facebookas, questions about how Hollywood really works, and I answer them. With me this week is one of the most encyclopedic minds in the world of crime fiction fandom, Nancy Clare, co-founder of Noir Magazine. Say hello.
Hello.
Hello. She has been tracking all of the best upcoming offerings in crime TV, crime novels, crime film, crime. Just what's going on out on like Venice Boulevard right now. She knows right now. If there's like a robbery at La Cienega, she knows about it, like in her mind already. That's right. And she's going to give her recommendations later in the show. I personally just need some guidance on whether I should be laughing at that new Ironside show or watching with muted concern. So I'll get my answer soon. Meanwhile, a reader has also written in asking whether Breaking Bad has the best series finale of all time quality-wise. I'm going to want to ping Nancy on that one. I actually also opened that question up to the loyal listeners, and we are going to share our definitive list. But first, let me introduce my VIP interview this week. Super fans of American soap operas already know the name Laura Lee Bell. If anyone is a daughter of soap opera royalty, it is she. Her parents, William J. Bell and Lee Philip Bell, have either created or written on pretty much every soap that's ever mattered, including Another World, Young and the Restless, Days of Our Lives, Bold and the Beautiful. Laura Lee herself is, of course, the actress behind Cricket Blair, the character who debuted as a little teenager, a real teenager, 14 years old, on Y&R in 1983, and still appears on that show on a recurring basis. Now, you all, my listeners, are apparently much more obsessed with soaps than I ever dare realize, so I collared Laura Lee to answer some of your most burning soap-related questions. We're on with Laura Lee Bell. Welcome to the podcast, Laura Lee.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Now, are you ready to answer some of my listener questions?
I am. They are always the best questions.
It looks like the best questions are all coming from one listener this week. It's Kyle R. We're going to start with the first one.
Great.
What are shooting schedules like, he asks. It seems like they would get less time to shoot because the material has to come out so fast compared to shooting a one-hour episode of TV per week, such as The Killing or Walking Dead.
True. And, you know, when I have done episodes of Castle or, you know, a CSI or whatever, they'll come up to me and say, "No, tomorrow's a big day because you have, you know, 5 pages. And I'm used to 40. So I just look at them and say, "Okay, I'll be ready. I promise. You know, thank you so much." But our schedule is crazy. No one can believe that we shoot, you know, sometimes 80 to 120 pages a day. So, you know, it's very long for our crew. They try and block, you know, kind of put our scenes together. So you may have a 6 o'clock in the morning call and be out by 2, or you may have a noon call and be out by 6 p.m. The only thing that people never think about is, you know, you come home and you're exhausted and all of that, but then you have to pick up the script. There's no, like, downtime. You have to pick up the next day, 30 pages, cram in your head before, you know, 6 a.m. the next morning. So the homework that we have as adults is just something that nobody seems to think about, and, you know, why would they? But that's the part of the schedule that's really grinding.
You know, it's interesting that you say that you talk about memorization. I went to a talk last night between the actors Bob Odenkirk and Jeff Garlin. And Bob Odenkirk was talking about his memorization technique for the show Breaking Bad. And he said his technique was to start saying the lines out loud in the manner of Robert Evans. So is there any technique that soap opera actors use to learn all that so quickly?
Well, I mean, there are definitely tricks. I was trying to help my son yesterday with history homework and remembering, you know, I don't know, King Henry and you know, just trying to come up with... I think there was something with two C's, and I said, okay, that sounds like, you know, your cousin, CC, and there's an answer of, like, 13 articles in this. So imagine that CC is 13 years old. So there are tricks you have to do. And very often when we go up on our lines, we'll say like, oh, I know it's an S word or I know it's an R word, because we have these, you know, tricks, and we know we can visualize the word, but sometimes it just doesn't always come out. People that come on our show for a couple of days, you know, we'll be done, and they'll say, thank you very much, we'll see you tomorrow. And they're like, that is going on, you know, that's, we're done. Like, what about my close-up, or what about, you know, lighting? And what it's like right now in this day, if you get it right on the first take, unless it's an emotional scene and you really beg to do it again or whatever, that's pretty much your shot.
So you one take.
Prepared. Yeah, sometimes two. In the good old days, it was maybe five or six, or shooting it till you get it right. And now there is just, it's just come in and know your lines.
Why is it so much quicker now than it was then?
But just budget. You know, I think they want to try, and sometimes we shoot six shows in 5 days, or we've been taking some Mondays off, so sometimes you know, five and four.
And then you go over to Castle or something and you're like, oh my God, Nathan Fillion gets 10 takes?
I know. Wait, that's not cool. But, you know, sometimes I feel like your first, if you're on it, if you're prepared, sometimes I do feel your first take is your best, because at least for me, if it's already gone well in my head, I'll be like, uh-oh, the last take was better. The last take, you know, I'm still speaking and I'm listening to my coworker, but there's another little voice in my head going, oh, that was so, nope, it was better the first time.
So what, over at a show like Castle or some of the many, many guest roles that you've had, what is it like over there when it comes to number of takes and pacing?
You have to really remember continuity when you do something like that, because you have to make sure if you lift your hand up in a certain place in the master shot that when they come in for close-ups, you do the same mannerisms. So it's just a different way of working. I like them both. There's something about, you know, it's like when in the good old days too, we used to do like Young and Restless versus Price is Right on Family Feud.
Oh my God.
I used to go on Wheel of Fortune, and I loved at Family Feud, the speed round. And like, I loved that adrenaline rush and that, you know, heart pumping. And so that's sort of like, you know, Y&R. I mean, you get a new script every day. You're like responsible for cramming those words in, you know, doing your scenes and moving on to the next day. So there is that sort of rush of the speed.
Now, you started off as a teenager, right?
Yeah, I was received well, because back then, a 14-year-old girl would be cast by like a 22-year-old woman, and they would play young. And when I came on, and then they brought on another character, and then another, it was suddenly like a summer storyline that a lot of our fans and you know, viewers who watched, they had children over the summer, and they had suddenly a character to relate to. So it all happened by accident, but it all happened, you know, for a wonderful reason. And I feel lucky because my character really has grown up on TV, and it was never an age jump, or it was never... Yeah.
That's actually what another thing that Kyle R. is asking me about is, he notices that lots of times they'll cast a kid at age six, and next week the kid, it's a new actor who's like 16. Is that because the show wants to jump as quickly as possible to a character that viewers can relate to?
The reality is, if you really want a meaty, juicy storyline, you kind of have to bring them into the age of at least a teenager, to, you know, bring in the like sexual dynamic and the parental, you know, the teen versus the parent in terms of parenting and feuding and, you know, their lives changing and, you know, will they be a good child or a bad child? I mean, it just offers so much more story material. And nobody has a harder time hearing that they're going to age someone than me, because it does bring in sort of a fake factor. It would kill my father, who would have to do that at times. But, you know, it just provides a better story. And at the end of the day, that's what you're looking for.
Now, because you do come from soap opera royalty, your family, like we've discussed, has written for or created some of the most memorable soaps ever. I do have a writing question for you. Again, Kyle, I guess he's just like a crazy fan.
I love that, Kyle.
We love you, Kyle. For a soap that airs 5 days a week, he asks, how do the writers keep bringing out new storylines so fast? Aren't they ever afraid of accidentally repeating themselves? Also, do they even sleep? Because I imagine being a writer for a soap is one of the most stressful jobs you can have. Both of your parents were those. So tell me, what was it like in the household?
Yeah. I mean, such a great question. And so, first of all, like, there is no hiatus. You know, all these other shows that are on TV have their summer hiatus, have their break, have, we're only shooting 20 episodes this year. Wow, how fantastic. My dad had to come up with an hour of television, sometimes an hour and a half a day with no break, no chance for writer's block. He was like Joe Funny, Mr. Relaxed, loved a good hot dog, was always, always at home because he typed from, he worked from home, but I would never walk into his office and he would say, no, not now. I mean, occasionally they would have the group, not occasionally, always, they would have conference calls because we were in Chicago and some of the writers were in New York or Los Angeles, but I could still walk in and he would say, hold on a second, guys, and I'd say, I need my pink pants for school tomorrow, and that was never an issue.
Were you able to have family dinners? Were you able to have family vacations, or was it they were on it all night, every night?
No, always, like, completely. I don't remember him writing that much on the weekends. He would always have a red flare pen with him. He would always be jotting down notes and sticking them in his pocket. But no, we would drive to Wisconsin almost every weekend and stop at the cheese box and have, our same little routine and watch, like, Friday night. Every Friday night we would watch CPO Sharky and Heart to Heart and, Fantasy Island or Love It, like, if that was Saturday night. I don't know. Our weekends were very routine, very much like meeting at night and watching TV. And I just, sitting at a typewriter, at least he was present. He was always, like, in the room next door the next room. So I never felt like he was gone. If he would rarely come out to L.A. without us, or if he did, it was very brief.
Laura Lee Bell, thank you for joining the Femme Fatale podcast. If you're interested in more of what Laura Lee is up to these days, you can check out more on her two web series projects and her latest movie on my website at www.thefemmefatale.com. Now it's time for Nancy to shine on. Nancy.
Yes?
The next two reader questions are just for you. But before we start, I have been meaning to ask you how long you've been into crime fiction, because every time I talk to you, you're like, oh, Joe Smith. I talked to Joe Smith. Like, he's my friend. Like, I call him up.
Do you want me to go into the Nancy Drew days or the original, when I read Sherlock Holmes when I was, when I was about 8 or 9, Sherlock Holmes when I was about 10 or 11. And I won't tell you what decade that was in.
Okay.
But Gutenberg was still perfecting the printing press.
Right.
So it's always been, you would come home from school and reading all that stupid stuff like chemistry and French, and then I would start reading mysteries, Josephine Tay, Dorothy Sayers, Sherlock Holmes. I couldn't get enough of it.
Now I have to tell you a story that's going to bring pain to you. Are you ready for it?
I'm sitting down.
I just remembered this story, and every time I think about it, the pain is so awful. I had a Nancy Drew novel signed by Harriet Adams.
One of the Caroline Keynes.
One of the Caroline Keynes, and I gave it away because I didn't know Nancy. You were not in my life. No one was around to guide me and protect that. And I just, like, I gave it away to some other kid on the street. I gave away all my Nancy. And to this day, I think it's like a guy who gives away his baseball cards or his mom sells his comic books. So many of the men in my life have that story of, like, my mom sold my baseball cards, my mom sold my comic book. I did it to myself.
So it haunts you.
It really does haunt me. It haunts me that I don't have I used to have a whole row. I don't know how many Nancy Drew books you used to have, but you know how they used to have the numbers on them and the yellow jackets and all that stuff. I used to have probably a whole bookshelf row of them, and I gave them away, and I would do anything to have those back. Anything.
I think I kept mine for a long time, and then one of the earthquakes came along and crushed them. And same sort of story. My mother threw them away, but none of them had been signed. Should I want to get them again? They're there.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was, it happened.
Now, since then, you've become kind of an authority.
Well, I wouldn't go authority, but I'm certainly a...
I'm telling you authority.
Oh, all right, I'm an authority.
Yeah, okay, yeah. You're on my podcast. I'm telling you. Don't disagree with me on my podcast. You're an authority.
I certainly have done my share of covering the genre in print, and I'm a dedicated follower of crime fashion.
Crime fashion? Really?
Well,
do you have a fedora collection?
I don't have a fedora collection, but I do have trench coats.
No. Yeah, how many?
Four.
That's amazing.
And in Southern California, that's enough
that's
trench
very
coats.
Good.
That's enough trench coats to last many lifetimes.
But what you're too modest to say is that you've also co-founded Noir Magazine, and you recently moderated at Bloody Scotland, the second annual Bloody Scotland, where like big old rock stars.
Well, I recently attended it. I'm actually going to moderate a writer's block interview with Joe Nesbø, Norway's number one crime fiction writer. And former rock star, or current rock star, but former soccer player and economist. He's the ultimate hyphen.
That's amazing.
Hyphenate, excuse me.
Now, he's also, for those of you who are not familiar with Joe Nesbø, he wrote the Headhunters.
Headhunters and The Snowman, which was a New York Times bestseller, soon to be a major motion picture that had Martin Scorsese attached, but
until he
no
went around
longer.
Screaming? Wow. Yes. I know that Headhunters I really like because it had Jamie Lannister in it. And he's my favorite because he looks good.
Jamie Lannister speaking
Danish.
I'm not sure it was Danish or Norwegian, or I'm not quite sure what the association between those languages, Swedish, Norwegian, Danish.
Nikolai Coster-Waldau, right? So his name is like that. And somebody told me that he's actually Polish or something, which just totally threw me. He's from Westeros, people. He's from Westeros. Now, it's time for you to shine. Billy Zayak has a question for you. Read it aloud.
Billy Zayak asks via Facebook,
what?
Will there be more Canadian-produced crime dramas set in Canada in the future, considering the vague successes of shows like Motive and Continuum?
You also got a second reader question. Do you want to tackle this one first?
All right.
Okay.
Shane Tharp asks via Twitter, name the one new series that everyone should read. Also, King's Joyland. Was it crime or murder mystery? And if she'd praise Sue Grafton on the show, that'd be great. So I'll take these in reverse order.
Okay, very good.
Let's start with Sue Grafton.
All right. I'm not a fan.
How can you not like Sue Grafton?
Is she one of the ones who write about the cats? Oh, no, I'm sorry. She's the one who did the alphabet.
She's doing the alphabet mysteries, and she's now up to W.
Okay, but I can't.
But there's an interesting thing about Sue Grafton.
I can't get into it.
And she had an unlikely influence on the likes of Lee Child, who is the author of the hard-boiled Jack Reacher series. Was made into a motion picture with Jack Reacher was made into a motion picture with Tom Cruise, for good or for ill. But he had an interesting thing to say in Scotland, which was that when he was starting the Reacher series, he had read Sue Grafton's series, the first few. He liked the idea that it was limited to a certain number, numbers of the letters of the alphabet. He himself was going to do a 21 book series for Jack Reacher as an homage to Travis McGee, those mysteries. And he said, Sue Grafton and Kinsey made me think that my character was going to have to be a certain way. He was going to have to go buy clothing and only carry a toothbrush as luggage and buy clothing and discard clothing because he won't be doing laundry if he's wandering around the United States.
Right.
And I thought that's an incredibly interesting thing to say about Kinsey, I guess, was the first detective to do laundry in her books.
And now every major author thinks, how would my character have to handle laundry, have to handle clothes?
Have to handle life. It's not a Philip Marlowe sort of gliding in and out, or sort of the equivalent of Erica Jean's zipless fuck.
Okay.
You know, it's they live a life, and it made someone like Lee Child think, my character is going to have to live a life. And I think that that's an interesting thing. I think that's an interesting influence of one writer who I cannot think of someone more different than Lee Child, than Sue Grafton. But it also speaks to how these writers influence each other, which is, you know, it's
in odd ways.
In odd ways, you know, like because of Sue Grafton, Jack Reacher will only carry a toothbrush.
And that is some excellent praise.
I think so, from no less than Lee Child, who is a pretty smart guy. Now, King's Joyland, it was the Amazon Book of the Month in June of 2013. Very well received. It was printed by Hard Case Crime, which is run by a man named Charles R. Dye. And I would say it is a murder mystery as opposed to a crime. And I define the difference between the two accordingly. A crime is usually what's considered a procedural. It's a detective that's going to be investigating a crime and he's going to come to a solution. It's a murder mystery is usually something that happens and someone other than a detective is going to discover what happened. And it's a little bit different. Procedural is different than a murder mystery. There's no, in Joyland, there were no police. The main character was not a policeman. And also, whenever you have Stephen King, you've got the spooky element. And Joyland had that. So I would put it into the mashup category of crime fiction, horror crime fiction, spooky, otherworldly crime fiction.
Worth my time?
I don't know. I think if you're going to dive into a Stephen King, I would read Dr. Sleep.
Okay.
Which is the sequel to The Shining, the scariest book ever written.
Oh, that's new, right?
It's new. And I'm about 200 pages into it, and man, is it scary.
Really?
And it's a mystery.
Speaking of mysteries, and where does a whodunit fit in to a murder mystery versus crime?
Well, a whodunit to me is a murder mystery.
Okay.
A murder has happened, and people Miss Marple comes out, but it's usually a non-professional that's seeking the solution or stumbles on the solution. A procedural is someone who goes through the steps. So when I think of procedurals, I think of Harry Bosch, and
right.
I think of Michael Connelly's mystery series. Those are procedural. Those are crime novels. A mystery is more like Michael Connelly's other character, Mickey Haller. He stumbles into mysteries. His half-brother, Harry Bosch, solves mysteries as part of a procedural. It's a fine line, but I perceive them as different.
So technically Scarpetta, even though Scarpetta is a medical examiner, I consider that to be crime.
Yes,
she's still going through.
That's a procedural. She's an she's an official person investigating.
Empowered with them,
You know, using science or the art of detection or whatever. She's not, it's not something that happens. There's a murder and she's trying to suss it out and what it means. Because usually to the detective, what it means is a job. It's his or her job. In a murder mystery, it might not necessarily be the protagonist's job.
Final question then.
Yes.
Sherlock Holmes, not really his job, but people make it his job. Ergo, that is a...
Well, I like to think of that as the first buddy movie in print. But no, that is a procedural because he's using detecting techniques that John Watson is describing to solve a mystery. He usually it also means there's no personal involvement.
Okay. Okay, that's good. I like that.
I don't think that makes much sense.
No, I think it makes a lot of sense. Thank you very much.
So...
Canadian-produced crime dramas.
Oh, no. Wait a minute.
What?
Name the new series that everyone should read.
Oh, I've got one, too.
I think that everyone should go and look up How a Gunman Says Goodbye, which is the number two book in a series that a young Scottish writer named Malcolm McKay has written. It's the mystery series that everyone is talking about. When I say everyone, Michael Connelly, Lee Child, Robert Craze... Everyone is, he won the Scottish Mystery Book of the Year Award this year in Scotland. It is the series, it's going to be a series of three books that everyone is talking about. And it has a Don Winslow, who wrote Savages. It's got a Don Winslow sort of sensibility in the writing. It's a very cool, very, very cool series.
Now, you said number two.
I can't remember the first one.
Oh, okay. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that you weren't saying the first one isn't worth our time.
No, the first one would be worth your time.
Okay.
It is a series from the point, I would call it a murder mystery, sort of. It is a series from the point of view of a professional hitman.
Nice. I'm there already. Okay. My recommendation really quick, the Anno Dracula series by Kim Newman. It's a mashup of, I would say, mystery, horror, drama, comedy, and spoof. The series asks the question, what would have happened if Dracula had not been defeated at the end of Bram Stoker's novel? It reimagines all of world history as if that defeat had never happened. As it turns out, Dracula kind of would have taken over the world, starting with Victorian London. Highly recommend the series. And it is crime, too, so don't argue with me. Okay, final question. Will there be more Canadian-produced crime dramas set in Canada? As a Canadian, shouldn't you, like, innately know this genetically?
I would say yes, okay. As long as the government of Canada and the provinces give such tremendous tax breaks to production companies to make their television series in Canada. So you'll see more of series like Continuum and Motive, which was on ABC. And keep in mind that Orphan Black was shot in Toronto.
Love it.
And Copper, which is a crime series, also shot in Toronto.
Is that worth my time?
I think it's worth your time. It's an interesting look at an interesting time in the United States, even though it's shot in Toronto.
You know, every time I see that on Netflix, we sort of pass it over and I say, oh, look, Copper. And my husband kind of makes a grunting noise and then we just keep going. So next time I hear that grunting noise, I'm going to say Nancy liked it.
Well, I did. I wouldn't put it at the same place as other shows, not necessarily shot in Canada, like The Americans.
You like The Americans better?
Very. Americans, definitely worth it.
Is that still on? I should know better.
Second season's coming up. Or The Bridge.
Oh, do I want to see The Bridge?
You want to see The Bridge.
You know what you want to see?
What?
Broadchurch.
Oh, I saw Broadchurch.
Oh, okay. Then forget I forgot who I was talking to. All right, I'm done. That's for my listeners then. You should be watching Broadchurch, but not Top of the Lake. I did not like to. You're looking at.
No. I didn't like it either. Huge argument with my partner in Noir Magazine, Rip Georges. Huge argument.
He liked it.
I thought it was bad Bergman.
Me too. I thought it was a huge waste. I keep saying way more with my time. I just thought there were entire subplots that did not serve the main plot, didn't have any purpose. I don't like that. I believe that every scene should push a plot forward. And when it doesn't, it shouldn't be there. And I think that half that show, the whole scene of the shipping container women, I don't think that led anything to anything, did it?
It was so self-consciously quirky.
Yeah. All right. Nancy.
Yes.
Do you want to ask the next reader question?
I certainly will.
Okay, go for it.
Doc Turv seeks via the Femme Fatale website.
Yes.
Where will the final episode of Breaking Bad fall in pantheon of series finales? I'd love to hear your rankings.
Were you a Breaking Bad fan?
Oh, lived and breathed Breaking Bad.
Mm-hmm. And were you brokenhearted? Were you broken batted when it was over?
All good things, as in really badass things, have to come to an end. I thought it was pretty close to perfect.
I thought so, too. Now, my readers have written in with suggestions on their favorites, their favorite series finales. And this is what listener Andrew Six says, that he liked 6 Feet Under. Not only did they end the show, we got to see a rare glimpse into the lives of the characters after the show ends, including their eventual individual deaths. How apropos. It helped with the closure of the series. The final scene of Claire driving down an increasingly lonely highway, split with the scene of her eventual passing, has always been indelible in my head. Former co-host Alex Robinson writes, it went beyond wrapping up plot lines and onto the greater theme of living life, etc. So, were you a 6 Feet Under fan?
Yes, and I agree. I thought that was pretty close to perfect until Breaking Bad.
Until Breaking Bad.
Although, they're pretty much neck and neck. I mean,
you wouldn't rank one above the other in that particular case?
Well, they were very different.
Okay.
But they both had the same result. The lead character died.
Oh, speaking of what happens to the lead character at the end of a series, did you watch the ending of Dexter?
No, I've never been a Dexter fan. Too much blood.
Really?
Yeah.
Because it's technically a mystery from the other end.
No, I agree. And I just, for someone who likes death and mysteries and crime, I'm rather squeamish.
Do you prefer shootings and poisonings to stabbings?
Yes, absolutely. Shootings, so much. It's something about slice and dice that just doesn't work for me.
So a novel about an arrow to the neck.
Well, a novel is different because I don't see the blood spurting head.
Okay.
But on the screen, I do.
Okay.
I have to close my eyes.
Okay, so Game of Thrones is probably not your thing.
Oh,
either.
No. Love Game of Thrones, however.
Okay.
Go figure.
But there's a lot of arrows in that one,
yeah,
as opposed to stabbings.
A lot of arrows and throats being cut. And
you're okay with that?
Weirdly, yes, because it's a mythical place. Dexter isn't. Dexter could be real.
Dexter could be real, but it wasn't. We're safe now. We're safe. We're safe, Nancy. Newhart. People don't typically like it was all a dream endings, but this one was great for fans. Because Bob wakes up. Are you a fan of this show?
Oh, yes.
Bob woke up next to the TV wife from his previous show. The Bob Newhart show, and said he had this crazy dream about running an inn, which is the plot of Newhart.
Suzanne Plachette.
Suzanne Plachette, the beautiful Suzanne Plachette. And Andrew Six, one of my listeners, put it this way. Said it was absolute brilliance and the perfect way to end the series. The characters were always lovable, but a bit surreal. So being fictionalized dream characters in Bob's head made a hell of a lot more sense in some respects. Now, I'm going to add Cheers, the finale of Cheers, to this. And do I have sentimentality for the 80s? Yes, because it's when I was a teenager and my mind was very soft and it absorbed a lot of things and my head wasn't hard yet. So I liked everything I saw. So that's my fault. But Sam, the whole purpose of that show was about bartender Sam trying to relive some past to make himself happy again. But in the final episode, he realizes that he's happy then. And that final scene where he locks the front door to the bar and somebody tries to get in and he says, sorry, we're closed. Maybe it's because I was young, but I liked it. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Did you have an opinion on the Seinfeld ending?
I love Seinfeld, and I think Seinfeld is the Talmud for the modern age. I think anything
nice.
That happens has a Seinfeldian regifting, lesser babka. I mean, Seinfeld just infuses the urban life and the urban landscape. But the final episode, meh.
So then you must not have been a fan of the show that influenced that episode. Have you ever watched Sergeant Bilko, the Phil Silver show?
Didn't they have a television?
Oh, they didn't. Did they? They didn't give Canadians each
no,
Canadian
didn't
get a free television.
No, they didn't let us have televisions.
Really?
Actually, my parents didn't let us.
So
have
you had
television.
To settle for free health care.
Yeah, settle for free health care and no television.
I think that's okay.
Well, I'm very bad in the TV category of Trivial Pursuits because of it.
I feel your pain. But lots of people criticize that Seinfeld episode for being too vindictive toward its characters. But I believe it was perhaps truer to its characters than any other sitcom in recent memory. These people are misanthropes. They don't get along.
Well, no, they're dreadful
people.
They
don't play well with others. If you met them, they most likely wouldn't like you or be particularly nice to you unless you could make money for Kramer or help one of the others find a parking spot. And so the ending in which they are locked in jail for essentially not being good citizens is actually pretty great. And it also does homage to another terrific series. Like I said, the finale of Sergeant Bilko, the Phil Silver show. Go rent it. Trust me. Now, a lot of people said Quantum Leap. I was never a Quantum Leap person, but the episode was Mirror Image. And the reason why our listener Eric A. told me he liked it was because it didn't go for a sappy or a happy ending. We learn that the main character, the time traveler Sam, never returns home. And Father Shane Ian Tharp told me Quantum Leap was perfect because it stayed true to the world it created and didn't wimp out and give a totally clean finish. I also have to put The Wire on my personal list because the very last episode of The Wire was basically a giant thank you note to the city of Baltimore. And all it did was show pictures of real people in Baltimore at the very end, a montage of the people of Baltimore. I thought it was beautiful.
I have to agree.
Now, the only other two on this list, my mom wrote in saying she liked the Sopranos ending. Now, a lot of people hated the Sopranos ending. My mom liked it. She said, I like Imperioli's take on the diner scene and cut to black. Tony dies, quote, you remember some little details and something catches your eye and that's it. You don't know the aftermath because you're gone. Fade to black. And then there was also this dream sequence. Were you a big fan of Saint Elsewhere?
No. What's his name? Morse. The lead character. I can't stand him. The actor.
The end, it turns out it was another one of these, it was all a dream tropes. But in this particular case, Saint Elsewhere is inside the actual hospital where everything takes place is apparently just an imaginary hospital inside this a snow globe being held by an autistic little boy. If you've got a vote for the worst series finale ever, and keep in mind that Battlestar Galactica happened, you can write to me, tweet me at Femme Fatale Says, and let me know. That about wraps it up for this particular show. If you guys want to reach me, here's how you can reach me. You can tweet me at Femme Fatale Says. You can write to me via the comments section of my website at www.thefemmefatale.com, or you can find me on Facebook. Nancy, if somebody wants to argue with you about your choices today, where can they reach you?
I have a recent article in The Rap Sheet, which is at www.therapsheet.com, and I've also written an interview and profile of mystery writer Lindsay Fay, and that can be found at lareviewofbooks.org.
And they can just savage you in the comments.
They can savage me in the comments, but don't.
That just about does it. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you next week.